This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The United States last modernized its immigration laws 50 years ago, before the Immigration and Naturalization Act took effect, and now 50 years later, and perhaps from the beginning, we have struggled to come to terms with what it means to be a nation of immigrants. And now, immigration policy is playing a role in the presidential campaign. We have a front row seat to the battle between immigration policy and immigration politics, with millions of people caught in the middle. Queen's University of Charlotte is hosting a forum to shed light on what this election may mean for immigration reform. That forum is tomorrow night at 5:30 in the Duke Energy Auditorium at Rogers Hall on the campus. And we have information about that on our website at WFAE.org. In advance of that, we're joined by several experts on the topic. Kathy Brennan is an immigration attorney at International House, which helps immigrants with their legal needs, including citizenship. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
For those not familiar with International House, give us a little thumbnail.
Yes, certainly. International House has been serving the Charlotte community for over 25 years. And they have three separate and distinct programs. One is a citizen diplomacy program, where we bring diplomats from all over the world to participate in mentoring-type programs. And then we have an education department where we have English as a second language, including one-on-one tutoring and civics classes. And then we have the law clinic, where we serve asylees, refugees, and low-income immigrants.
Which is why you're here, because you can shed light on their experience.
Yes, thank you.
Dr. Margaret Cummins is Assistant Professor of Political Science and International Studies at Queen's University of Charlotte. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
And Dr. Gregory Weeks is back with us. Dr. Weeks is Professor and Chair of the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UNC Charlotte. Good to see you again.
Nice to see you.
Since the passage of the Immigration and Naturalization Act in 1965, that's a long time ago, 59 million immigrants have settled here. That means that 14% of the population here is foreign-born, the highest percentage since the early 20th century, I'm told, when immigration concerns were also high. So are the same forces at work again for the same reasons we have this perception that we're being flooded? Is that what's going on here, in part?
I think that's definitely what's going on in part. If you look at the increase in the immigrant population over the past 30 years, it's been significant, 7.9% of the population, total population in 1990, and now 14% of the total population. And it's been particularly strong in what they call new gateway states, southern states in particular, that have seen 200-300% increases in immigrant population. So you have the same sort of dynamic of a sort of backlash to that prestige change.
But unless you are a Native American, and there are not many Native Americans, that you are an immigrant, or you are the child or great-grandchild or great-great-grandchild of someone who came here from somewhere else. So why do we have this troubled relationship with immigrants and immigration?
Well, I would say that it's based a lot on race and ethnicity, so that each differing wave of immigration over time is somebody who is different. They look different from you. They sound different from you. And for a lot of people, that's always threatening. Who that has been over time has changed. It might be Irish. It might be Polish. It might be Italian. It might be Mexican. It might be Honduran. But that sort of anxiety seems to be a constant.
And you bring up an interesting point, because in 2014, the immigrant population here stood at more than 42.4 million, or 13.3% of the population. And of that 42 million, 28% were Mexican immigrants. Immigrants from Latin America and Asia have been dominating newcomers to this country in the late 20th and early 21st century, as opposed to the early 60s, when people came from Europe primarily. So is that what's fueling this, the fact that we have people from other cultures, other parts of the world, other than Europe here, or is it that many of them come here illegally? Or is that just the red herring? Is that just a way to latch on to it?
Well, in my opinion, I think the fact that people are here illegally certainly plays a part, but I think just the way people look and sound, if people are speaking Spanish, that feels threatening to me. Mm-hmm. If I have to push two for English, that feels threatening to me. So I think that actually is playing a pretty significant role.
When the Irish came here, well, the Irish speak English, but when the Italians came here and the Polish came here in great waves, you, of course, you couldn't press one for English because there were no buttons to press on the phone. But how did we deal with people who did not speak the language? And why do we get upset when we have special services for those who don't speak English? Why do we get upset?
Well, we had the same sort of reaction even when it was European immigrants coming. In the early 20s, of course, we passed legislation that had national immigrant quotas to keep out people from certain areas of Southern Europe and Eastern Europe. So we've always had this success of it's just who's coming that's changed, not necessarily the reaction to those people who are coming.
And we have gotten ourselves in the news business in trouble with certain groups of people who support undocumented immigrants by calling them illegals. And you work with these people every day, Kathy. So tell me what the term should be. They're undocumented. They're they're not here. They didn't come through legal channels. So how should they be referred?
Well, some of these have come through legal channels. I don't know the statistic, but I want to say the last I heard was 40% are visa overstays. So they have come either on a work visa or a student visa or a visitor visa, and the visa ran out, and they have just stayed. Mm-hmm. So those are amongst this group of undocumented. And then, of course, there are people that have been essentially smuggled into the country.
Right. Well, so, but you haven't answered my question.
But those are all those are all undocumented immigrants.
All right. Not illegal immigrants.
Well, there's a connotation to that term that is offensive to a lot of people. And so the fact is they don't have documents to prove.
Does that happen in other countries? Could I get a visa to visit some other country and simply stay forever because I just overstayed the visa?
And with the reciprocity program, you know, you can or the waiver program, you can go some places without a visa,
right,
and stay. Now, you could get in trouble for this just like you can in the United States.
Yeah. If you can be found. We have done many, many programs on this, and we've had guests on both sides of the immigration issue sit around this table and talk about this. But every single one of them, no matter which side of the table they're on or the issue they're on, has said that our immigration system is broken. If you agree that our immigration system is broken, in what way is it broken, and why does there not seem to be any political will to fix it?
Well, I think it's broken because it doesn't have a pathway of citizenship to citizenship for these undocumented people. And
well, let's get to the root of the problem here, because they're here illegally because they can't get in, many of them, legally, because it takes a very long time to get in legally. Is that correct?
Yes.
Lots of hoops to jump
through. That is correct. For certain family members, U.S. citizens and lawful permanent residents can apply for certain family members, and the wait for those visas can be up to 20 years. So,
is that overly difficult? Is that more difficult than it would be to do it in another country, to come into another country? Do we know?
I mean, I don't know about other countries. I mean, other countries are going to have similar types of laws in place, but it's going to vary considerably across different countries.
Because what's broken about it? I mean, if that's what's broken about our system, and I'm telling you, people on both sides of this issue, people who want to send them all back, all 11 million of them back, and people who say we should give them a path to citizenship, they both say the system is broken and it needs to be fixed.
Well, if you talk to employers, employers want to have an easier way to bring in workforces from abroad. So in terms of our current policy, it gives preference to families, right? But it has to be an immediate family. And then there's a very smaller number of preferences that goes to employers. And employers have to pay a lot of money and jump through a lot of hoops to get people in. So employers don't particularly like the system. You have the problem of undocumented migration. You have a quarter of the foreign-born population is undocumented. And of that, over 60% of them have been here more than 10 years. These are people with families, people with roots in the community. The idea that we're just going to summarily, you know, deport them all, it doesn't sit well with people. And we were talking before we came in, a majority of people in both parties believe that we should have a path to citizenship or some path to legalization, but we don't seem to be able to get there in the political conversation.
I would just add one thing, kind of going off what Maggie said, is that there's really a capitalist dynamic at work. There's supply and demand. And supply and demand is happening whether or not the government wants it. But there's been no sort of sense of flexibility on the federal government side to say, okay, we're going to recognize that and set up a system that can adapt to it.
Meaning that businesses need certain workers and they have to go someplace else to get them because either Americans
right.
don't want them or they're not educated in that area, so we need to bring them in from other countries?
Right. That's right.
Because one of the problems is that we do bring a lot of foreign-born students into the country and give them really good technical educations, and then they have to leave even though they want to stay and we could benefit from their expertise that we gave them.
Absolutely. We see this at Queens all the time. We have students who come through our program and would love to stay and work here, but I have two of them who graduated last year, and both of them are trying to work through their employers here in the States to be able to stay because it's the only way they can.
So is it because it takes so long to come here through channels that we have seen this flood of immigrants, undocumented immigrants, being smuggled in over our southern border, or are other forces at work here? Is it simply that things are so bad in those countries in Latin America that they have to come here for their own safety, or what they feel is their own safety, or for job opportunities? And they'd come here whether or not the process was 20 years or 3 years. They'd still come.
Well, I think it's both of those factors. I think there are some that come and don't have a family member here that could have applied for them, that could have brought them here through legal channels. And then, of course, there are some that we saw from Latin America that were coming here to seek refuge from a very violent situation in their home countries. And they're really more refugees or asylees. They have to come here and apply for asylum.
So the system as it's set up now, if you want to come here legally through channels, what do you have to do?
Well, if you have a family member that can apply for you, a spouse, a child, or a parent, then they file a petition here in the United States, and it works its way through the Department of Homeland Security and then through the State Department and then ends up in an embassy wherever they're going to process, and they go through a process there that involves criminal background checks and medical checks. And then there, of course, are fees involved, and you have to prove that you have that the U.S. citizen or lawful permanent resident that's applying for them has to prove that they have the financial means to support that immigrant.
And if you have nobody in this country, if you know no one in this country, what are your chances of getting in if you want to come?
Well, if you were an entrepreneur, then you can apply for yourself. If you are a refugee, designated refugee in another country, or an asylees come here and then apply for the asylum status.
How many people get in every year legally?
You know, I was looking for the statistic for that before I came here, and I couldn't find it.
It's close to a million.
So
close to a million a year.
Which is a lot. And a lot of people want to come here for various reasons and for obvious reasons. If we let them all in, what would it be like?
Well,
go ahead. 30 seconds.
We actually had dinner with an editor from The Economist several years ago, and he told us, well, you know, you have this huge country and only 330 million people. You could take an extra 500, 600 million and not even notice.
Okay. With that, we'll take a break. Coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Doctors Making House Calls, over 75 clinicians making more than 85,000 home visits annually, providing comprehensive primary care to patients in their home, workplace, or senior community. Information and registration at doctorsmakinghousecalls.com. And Tyndall Subaru Gastonia test drives are available for the new 2016 Crosstrek SUV with EyeSight safety technology that sees problems and initiates action to help avoid trouble. Details at Tyndall BeckelSubaru.com. The Beckler Museum of Modern Art's new exhibit looks at the intersection of mid-20th century modern art and modern design, featuring items that were not only artistic but functional, revolutionary in its time, but that philosophy remains influential in today's world, and we hear more about that. And then, the realization of an effort of two friends, former Mayor Anthony Fox and musician Wynton Marsalis, the Charlotte Jazz Festival, both tomorrow on this program at 9.
On the next Diane Reim Show, results from the New York Democratic and Republican presidential primaries, what the results mean for party rivals, the delegate scramble ahead, and ongoing questions about the American campaign system.
Join the conversation on the Diane Reim Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about immigration today in advance of a Queen's Considered Forum, which will be tomorrow at Queen's University in the Duke Energy Auditorium at Rogers Hall on campus, which is open to the public, and you can find more information about that on our website. We're talking with Kathy Brennan, immigration attorney at International House, Dr. Margaret Cummins, assistant professor of political science and international studies at Queen's University of Charlotte, and Dr. Gregory Weeks, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UNC Charlotte. Had we reformed our immigration system in this country years ago when people started talking about how it's broken and needs to be fixed, would many of the same people who have come here through undocumented means have gotten here through legal channels? Do you think?
You know, I don't know the statistic on that, but that's probably not likely. I think most of the people that came here because they didn't have that means. But there are some that do have family members here, mm-hmm. but didn't want to wait to be reunited with their families.
So has the flood of undocumented immigrants been rising? Is it steady? Mm-hmm. Has it been falling in recent years after the recession? What's been going on?
It's falling. It reached its peak in 2007 before the recession, and it's been falling since. In fact, net migration over the southern border is zero now.
Is there some kind of a lag time? Because it doesn't seem to make sense that we're having this conversation at the presidential campaign level if the number of people crossing the border is diminishing, not increasing.
Yes, I think that's definitely true. But I think you also, in a presidential primary campaign, what you're having is candidates playing to their bases, right? Okay. So it's not the median of opinion.
Well, it has become a topic of conversation, particularly on the Republican side, although the Democrats have been talking about this. Several of these candidates have vowed to deport immigrants who are here illegally. The merits or the possibility of that aside, are any of them, any of these candidates, Democratic or Republican, talking about reforming the system?
Yeah, I think you're seeing that more on the Democratic side. There's not necessarily a lot of specifics, given how complex the issue is, but you're seeing that more on the Democratic side, much less on the Republican side. John Kasich a little bit, but other than that, not really.
Would you call the Immigration and Naturalization Act of 1965 immigration reform in its time?
Sure.
Oh, absolutely.
So what would immigration reform ideally look like in 2016 or 2017? What would it look like?
Well, the Senate passed a bill in 2013, and that seemed to be sort of where the parties could meet in the middle on immigration. So you have a combination of border enforcement, border security to stop the flow of undocumented migration, increased visas for employment-based migration, and then some sort of path to citizenship that would include paying back taxes and paying some sort of fines and being in good standing with the law and education, those sorts of things. And that seemed to be where the compromise was in the Senate, but that was not able to make it through the House.
Yeah, Hillary Clinton has said that she would create an Office of Immigrant Affairs and would work to put undocumented immigrants on a path to citizenship. Bernie Sanders advocates comprehensive immigration reform, and the fact that we need to provide the 11 million undocumented immigrants legal protections and a path toward citizenship. Ted Cruz has a detailed plan on his website that he refers everybody to, but he says, bottom line, he will secure the border and end illegal immigration. John Kasich would lock down the borders, make illegals pay a penalty, but not provide a path to citizenship. And Donald Trump believes in legal immigration, but says those here illegally have to go. And, of course, he would build a wall and have Mexico pay for it. Why are Democrats seemingly more tolerant than Republicans on this issue?
Well, I think there's some compassion, and I think there's also a realization that the reality of rounding up 11 million people and forcing them out of the country is just remote. And so why make these people live in the shadows? Mm. And why not give them an opportunity to be fully engaged in their community?
Do most undocumented immigrants come by mule, and by that I mean those people who you pay $10,000 to smuggle you across the border, do they come across the southern border in the dead of night, or do they come on an airplane and just simply disappear once they get off the plane and go through customs?
That's changed over time. So in the 1990s, when we had this big spike in migration, particularly from Latin America, they came largely over the southern border. But now the majority come by overstaying visas.
Because when I hear about people spending $10,000, very poor people gathering enough money to come here, $10,000, I'm thinking, why don't you just buy a plane ticket?
Well, and these
and say you're planning to visit Disney World and just disappear into the country.
Because someone applying for a plane for a visa from Ethiopia isn't going to get one. They're not going to get a visit. They're not going to get a visitor visa from Mexico.
But they're not coming from. They're not sneaking. The people from Ethiopia aren't sneaking across our southern border, are they?
Sure,
they're
Eritreans. But okay. Yeah, sorry, excuse me.
So when Ted Cruz says that he will secure the border and end illegal immigration, is that possible?
No, it's not possible.
It's not possible.
It's only possible if you essentially made the U.S. into a fortress that was literally wall-to-wall, 100 feet tall. I mean, you could conceivably do it if that's the only thing you ever spent money on.
And why aren't they coming across the northern border, or are they?
There's certainly some migration over the northern border, but not nearly as much as over the southern border.
I mean, if we shut down, if we build the wall that Donald Trump wants to build, could people get a ticket to Canada, and then just simply come across our northern border?
Well, I think, again, there's that issue of the Canadian government is going to require a visa unless you are from one of those countries where they don't require a visa. But the people that are trying to get over here and seek asylum, they come from countries where Canada's not going to give them a visa either. So they do have to get to a country where they can sneak in.
Okay. And they can sneak in from Mexico because?
Well, they come all the way up through Latin America,
right,
up into Mexico.
That's a long trip.
It's a long, dangerous trip, because just to get to Latin America from some of these countries, just to get out of the country that they're from, is dangerous.
So if you build a wall across the southern border, whether or not Mexico pays for it, would that stop it?
No, I don't think so. I mean, what it would stop is the economies of every single U.S. border city in the United States.
So.
Because movement of people and goods is what fuels the southern part of the U.S.
Well, there'd still be gateways in and out of the country for trucks and cars and.
But if we're talking about the kind of enforcement that you hear about, a lot of that's just going to simply be shut down because you can't have, you know, like this one little doorway that people can funnel into. It's very, very hard to have something that would be.
But doesn't every legal entity, every commercial entity, a trucking company bringing goods in, tomatoes in from Mexico or strawberries in from Mexico, aren't they coming through customs? Aren't they coming through portals in the border that we've set up?
Yeah, but there's many of them, right? And so if you put up a wall everywhere, I suppose you could get people to funnel in different directions. But the more enforcement that you put at the border, the more you tighten it down, we found this out after 9/11, the more you hurt the economies of U.S. border cities. It's just how it works. That kind of enforcement, if it takes you 3 hours to get through the border, people are working on both sides, trucks are going through, stuff's not going to get where it's supposed to go.
Right. Well, how does it work now? They just drive across the border where there's no customs crossing?
I mean, no, it's just a matter of how long they have to sit in those lines at the border entry points and how much inspection is done of their trucks and their goods and the people who are coming through. So the more inspection, the more arduous is that inspection, the longer that it takes. If you see pictures of the border crossings, you see trucks lined up literally for miles behind.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, that's a lot of money. That's
and
a lot.
And that would change if you put up a a wall?
No, I mean, you could. So the whole discussion is where you spend the money, right? Resources are limited. The question of a 21st century border, which is something that we've been working on with Mexico for a while now and with border state governors, is that you spend that money making those processes at the legal openings more efficient. Or you can spend that money in the other 2,000 miles of border that we have where it's not as – where goods and services are not coming over.
But undocumented immigrants are not coming here through the legal openings in the border.
Well,
at
some do.
Some aren't.
Yeah, some
sure,
are.
They're hidden.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah,
they're
that's
hidden,
why –
they're hidden in trucks. And
right. That's right.
Yes, yes.
That's why – I mean, there is security. If you drive to California, as I've done a couple of times, you get into Arizona, you're going to have to drive through checkpoints. There's checkpoints in California if you want to drive north from San Diego to L.A. Why? Because people come in trucks. They come hidden in vehicles.
And how do you solve that? I mean, if you don't stop the trucks and search the trucks, how do you solve
that? Well, again, it's a question of technology, right? So we have good technology for border points of entry, but we don't have the money to spend on it because we're spending money building a wall. I mean, they are not mutually exclusive. You could spend money on both, but in an era of limited resources, we aren't, right? So we're putting most of the money, $50 billion plus, on this wall. We have 700 miles of this wall built thus far, but it's not an impermeable border by any stretch of the imagination. If we spend a lot more on that border fence, then we're not spending it on making those legal points of entry more efficient.
And even if you build the wall and you seal the border hermetically, never to be opened again, we still have the question of the 11 million people who are already here. If it isn't feasible, and I'm told by – I've heard presidential candidates say this, and I've heard other people say this, it's simply not possible to deport 11 million people. If that's not feasible, the other path that's been mentioned is finding some path to citizenship. And there is great resistance to this because in some people's minds, these people don't deserve citizenship. They broke the law to get here. They're criminals. So is there some middle ground here?
Well, I think that the immigration reform and what I've heard of President Clinton's plan is that there would be a fine, that they're going to have to pay a criminal penalty for having broken that law.
And it's a civil infraction, right? To cross the border illegally is a civil infraction.
No, it's a crime.
It's a criminal.
It's a crime. So Bobby emails, many people say that those who are in our country illegally should be granted some kind of status. However, how is this fair or even reasonable? We have family members in the legal immigration process. They are on a 12-year waiting list. During this time, they are not allowed to even visit the United States. How is it fair to reward those who broke the law and punish the ones who are following the rules?
Yeah, that's a good argument.
I think that's part of what's broken about the immigration system. If you look at the backlog of federal immigration judges, it's hundreds of thousands. If you have a judge and for some reason the case has to be postponed, it could be 8 months later. So that there's a terrible strain on the judicial system, and any kind of reform is going to have to include expediting that.
So the longer this goes on, the longer we have a broken system, the worse this is going to get. Maybe three years from now, there'll be 13 or 14 million people here with no papers, correct? So how do you fix – this is Byzantine. How do you fix this? Because there are so many factions and so many feelings tied up in this. Can you grant 11 million people something other than citizenship that gives them a right to stay based on whatever criteria?
Well, currently there is a deferred action for childhood arrivals, and that gives them the right to a work permit. And with the work permit, you can get a driver's license. So that brings them out of the shadows, but it is not a pathway to citizenship. And there is...
Why do we want to give them citizenship? What's the argument there?
I mean, you can obviously give just a lesser form of legal status than citizenship. You could have a pathway to legal status, green card holder, mm-hmm. without a path to citizenship. But the question of whether you want people living in a country, participating in the country without having a political voice, I think is an important one for people to consider. Because if you don't have citizenship rights, obviously you can't vote or participate in the political system in that way. So the question becomes, do you want a country in which you have a substantial portion of the population that cannot be politically involved?
One of the other arguments here is that these people who come here illegally are taking jobs from Americans, not paying taxes, taking from our social welfare system. How much of that is true?
Well, it would be very difficult for an undocumented person to be taken from our social welfare system.
Well, they go to the hospital, for instance. They get a cut on the job or they have an injury on the job because most of the people are in manual labor jobs. They go to the emergency room because they don't have money and they don't have health care and they don't have insurance, and we're picking up the tab. How much of that is true? I'm not saying that's true. I'm just saying how much of it is true. Do we know?
Yeah, I mean, I think especially in border cities, it is a strain. It's a strain because of the fact that they're undocumented, which then denies them the rights to access of services. So I think by and large, the more reasonable answer is how do you figure out a way to give them legal status, and that gives them the opportunity to not have to do that.
And the other thing is, I suppose, if they're being paid wages, and some of them aren't being paid, they're being taken advantage of, but if they're being paid wages, they're paying income tax automatically through W-2s.
Yes.
And they're also paying into the Social Security system, which
yes.
they will never have a legal path to withdraw
right.
from.
Exactly. That's right. And these are also people that, they're renting or they're somehow paying real estate taxes as well. They're paying sales taxes. They're paying taxes.
Mm-hmm. Why do people believe that they're not?
I think it's just misinformation or a misunderstanding of the way the system works.
One of the big problems, the biggest problem, I think, is what to do with children, because we keep seeing this particularly in the Southwest states. If children are born here of people who are here legally or illegally, they are citizens of the United States because they were born on the ground here, correct?
That's correct.
If they came across with their parents, some of them came across as toddlers, as infants, young children, and some of them have been here through grade school and high school, they don't know where they came from. They would be foreigners in their home countries. They are, by all measures, Americans, right?
They consider themselves as such, yes.
So how do you handle that? And right now, what do we do?
Well, right now, we do have President Obama has, by executive order, deferred action for childhood arrivals. And so, like I said, they can get a work permit, and in most states, they can then get a driver's license.
Does this idea of children soften opposition at all, or does it simply make people dig in their heels because we could stop this from happening if we just got control of the situation?
I think that polls show that there's a lot of support for not going after children who came here when they were 2 years old or something and had no choice. So I think that's one reason why President Obama pushed for that particular policy was because there was so much support even amongst people who otherwise would disagree with them on everything else with immigration.
Politicians would not be talking about any of this if on the stump particularly if they didn't believe it was a hot button issue for voters. In fact, according to the Gallup poll, immigration is the second most important problem facing the country today behind dissatisfaction with government, and I would wager that lack of movement on immigration is one of the things that makes them dissatisfied with government. Yet earlier this year, the Public Religion Research Institute released a report based on 40,000 telephone interviews showing that 60% of Americans believe there ought to be a path for citizenship for undocumented immigrants if they meet certain requirements. We'll talk about that and a few other polls on this issue when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Ballet, presenting SpringWorks, merging three ballets into one performance, including a new ballet featuring live jazz musicians, April 28th through 30th at Knight Theater. Tickets and information at charlotteballet.org. And Treliant Federal Credit Union, a member-owned, not-for-profit community credit union, 12 Charlotte area locations, including Ballantyne, Steel Creek, and Park Road. Treliant, life improved. Details at treliant.org. Results from the New York Democratic and Republican presidential primaries obviously are in, and so on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, they'll discuss the results and what they mean for party rivals, the delegate scramble ahead, and ongoing questions about the American campaign system. That's all upcoming, and if you'd like to join our conversation, now's your time. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, reach us at Charlotte Talks through Facebook or at WFAE on Twitter, and we are coming right back.
This week on Morning Edition, we bring you voices from the ground in Ecuador following a devastating earthquake there.
80% of buildings here in Pedernales were damaged somehow by the quake. So many people have lost their homes, lost their businesses, lost any worldly possessions.
We're also listening in New York, where a primary this week is shaping the race for the presidency. And in Appalachia, Steve Inskeep is talking to people about issues that matter to them. Listen to Morning Edition every weekday morning.
From 5 until 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Let me make a correction right here and now. We've been demoting Dr. Margaret Cummins. She is Associate Professor of Political Science and International Studies at Queen's University. Congratulations on your promotion.
Thank you.
Dr. Greg Weeks is Professor and Chair of the Department of Public of Political Science and Public Administration at UNC Charlotte. And Kathy Brennan is with us, an immigration attorney for International House, which is an organization that works to meet the legal, among other things, works to meet the legal needs of immigrants, including citizenship. I mentioned the Gallup poll a second ago, saying that the public thinks immigration is one of the most significant problems facing the country today. And then the Public Religion Research Institute releasing a report based on 40,000 telephone interviews, which is a lot these days, showing 60% of Americans believed there ought to be a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants if they meet certain requirements. Why is that not resonating politically?
Well, and what's interesting is that that's of both parties. So it's a higher percentage, you know, closer to 80% among Democrats, but it's well above in the high 60s for Republicans as well in some polls. So it's not as though it's an issue that is completely divisive of the parties. Mm.
55% of those responding to that poll, the Public Religion Research Institute poll, believe that immigrants, quote, strengthen the country because of their hard work and talents, which aligns with an email from Alan who says, the draw of the United States to people around the world is the freedoms to make a better life for themselves and their families, and the U.S. has benefited from many of these entrepreneurs creating big and little companies, hiring U.S. workers, and keeping us winning in global competition. Only 36% of the people in that poll say these immigrants are a burden, which is a small number of people when you think about it. The states with the dimmest view of immigration are West Virginia, Mississippi, Wyoming, Maine, and Alabama, states that have not historically experienced high levels of immigration, while California, Hawaii, New Jersey, and New York, which are historic centers for immigration, have the least concerns about it. Why the disconnect, do you think?
You know, we just, a colleague and I just finished a paper on this, and if you look nationally at the increase in foreign-born populations in states, it's a predictor both of the most number of restrictive anti-immigrant bills in a state and the most beneficial. So immigrant populations that are longstanding that have been in states for decades tend to moderate the sort of anti-immigrant forces that you have at the state level. Now we have a lot of state-level policy. But the states, particularly in the South, that have seen these huge increases in foreign-born population are still not up that curve yet, so they still have this sort of backlash to those populations. If you look at the states that deny in-state tuition to undocumented migrants, that deny driver's license, that have more enforcement of anti-immigrant type of policies, they're predominantly in the South.
Yeah, and part of the problem, I think, in the South, and particularly places like West Virginia, Mississippi, Alabama, may be that for 400, 500 years, the population mm-hmm. has been relatively homogeneous, correct? I mean, we all know each other, essentially. And so when somebody from the outside comes in, they're like peculiar, even if they're here legally.
Absolutely.
And therefore threatening.
Absolutely.
WFAE News spoke recently to Ken Fernandez. He is the – you might want to put your headphones on for just a second for this because I'm going to play a little clip. But Ken Fernandez is the director of the Elon University poll. They asked North Carolina voters a question about immigration in advance of the North Carolina primary.
We asked an open-ended question a few weeks ago and said, you know, what's the most important issue facing North Carolina? And, you know, education, the economy, jobs, wages, health care, those are the most prominent. Immigration and gay marriage, we found, were much, much lower than we've previously seen before. And that kind of surprised us, given that so many candidates had been talking about this. I think part of it has to do with there has been a little bit less media coverage about the European migration and refugee crisis, and that may have helped sort of alleviate some fears regarding immigration. So we've seen that become a less of a salient issue. However, I study immigration and attitudes on immigration. It is something that is always sort of dormant there, and it can, in just a split second, it can become far more salient. So, but right now, though, it seems to have sort of calmed down a bit.
That's Kent Fernandez, director of the Elon University poll. He mentioned the European migrant crisis. We've had our own issues about whether or not we should accept refugees from people fleeing Syria in this country. Is that a completely separate issue from what we've been talking about, or is it a tiny subset of the issue?
It's definitely a refugee policy is different than immigrant policies. It's a different area of the law. Refugees come under a different system, and they're restricted in a different way. So the president and Congress set an annual cap on refugees, which the president is trying to increase to 85,000 from 70,000. So in that sense, the policies are different, the politics are different. But in terms of the reaction, I think it's very similar.
Mm-hmm. I would just add one thing, too, is one difference is that the concerns that people have about refugees is tied to terrorism. So if people are coming from the Middle East, there's an assumption that some subset of those people are going to be terrorists. And when you're talking about immigrants from Latin America, that aspect really isn't there.
When you look at what's going on in Europe now, and although there's a backlash now, but Germany took in, I'm not sure how many.
Close to a million.
Yeah. And other countries over there took in similar numbers or slightly less. And we take in 85,000?
Not even. We take in 70 in the past several years, yes. But again, that's in a political election year. It's become a very divisive issue, and the president only has so much latitude on that.
Well, those refugees that are flowing into Europe are coming in a different way than the refugees would come into the United States. To come to the United States as a refugee, you've been determined to be a refugee by the United Nations, and you have been vetted. You've been vetted for years. The process can take up to 8 years for someone to finally make their way into the United States as a refugee. So they're interviewed at their refugee camp. They're interviewed again by the IOM, and then they are criminal background checks. Once they've come to the United States as a refugee, they must live here for a year, and then they can apply for lawful permanent resident status. And there's another criminal background check.
Mm-hmm.
Once they apply for citizenship, there's another criminal background check. It's not the same sort of endless flow of people that are coming in without any sort of check on them. Refugees that are coming here have been thoroughly vetted.
So in that Elon poll that Ken Fernandez spoke about a moment ago, the most pressing issue for voters in North Carolina was education. Nearly 30% put that at the top of their list of concerns, followed by jobs, employment, and wages at 19%. Next on the list was the economy at 8%, so a big drop-off, followed by health care and taxes, the environment and government, and then immigration at 2.26%. Assuming that there are other states where similar results might be found, are we witnessing immigration being a candidate issue only because it fires up certain party bases? And if that's the case, is that why it doesn't get fixed? Because it's an issue they can use at election time.
Yeah, I would say that also if you look at the way that we elect presidents, that you must go to your base. That's how you win primaries. And so there's a very, very strong incentive to whip up a very vocal minority. And I think with immigration, we're talking most of the time about a very vocal minority. And so I would agree, yes, is that you need to keep that in mind if you are in Congress, if you want to be president.
Which then made it difficult for Mitt Romney to shift course, because you go for your base during the primaries, and then when you're facing the whole country, you have to say, well, all that stuff I said, I don't exactly mean that. I mean something more centrist. But at the time when you're trying to get to the nomination, that's what you feel you have to do.
This is a little off the topic, but I have two political scientists here, one who was just moments ago promoted. So I have to ask, are a lot of the problems that we face in this country today the result of the primary system?
Well, not just the primary system, but if you look at Congress, you also have the gerrymandering issues with members of Congress being in districts that are overwhelmingly filled with people who are in their party, right? So the threat for members of Congress is in the primary, not in the general election. So in the primary, where people who turn out tend to be more ideologically either right or left, that's when you have to move that way, and that's when you get more conservative.
I want to add one other thing. You want to get electoral is that we have a system that does – it's not proportional representation, so that you – it's just a winner-take-all system.
Right.
And so you just grab a certain number of your base, and you can win even if your views don't necessarily represent entirely your district.
Should we be looking at that? Going
we
forward.
Absolutely should be yes. looking at that going forward.
Most political scientists would say yes.
Yes.
The likelihood of that ever happening is what, nil?
Really close to nil.
Really close to nil.
Gee, I wonder why. We have a couple of emails that have come in while we've been talking. Let me share them with you. When I was going through the process of getting my now husband to the U.S. via the fiancé visa, we were separated for 6 months, got different information based on who I spoke with inside the immigration agency. I could go on. And people inside the agency asked why I didn't just have him come on a visitor's visa and skip the legal process.
Oh, no.
Why?
Well, because when you apply for that visitor visa, you have to say, I'm just coming to visit and I'm going home.
But what if you come? What if you legitimately come to visit and you meet somebody and you fall in love with them and get married? Then what?
Then you've got yourself a pathway to citizenship.
So couldn't the same thing happen? I mean, if you're already in love, couldn't you just come in and say, I'm here to visit? Oh, look who I met.
You're interviewed for that visa, and
you
would have to lie. Plus, if immigration saw that you had a pending fiancé visa or a pending marriage visa, they're going to say – they're not going to give you that visitor visa. They're going to say, get a fiancé visa.
Michael writes, if we are really afraid that U.S.-trained foreigners will leave the U.S. with their valuable skills, one must ask, why are those university seats instead not filled with Americans? The implication is that U.S. citizens are too stupid or too lazy to learn or to be innovators. On the other end of the education spectrum, a professor at a Western university concluded that 58% of South American immigrants lack a high school education. Must we conclude that we need these high school dropouts for the jobs Americans won't do, because apparently we do not have enough of our own dropouts in inner cities and disadvantaged neighborhoods? The message is, don't even try. We don't need you. Two sides of the same coin.
Well, I don't think that there's any evidence that there's a restricted number of seats in U.S. universities that Americans who want to go to university and learn, particularly in the math and sciences, can't find a seat to do so. So it's not as though we have a limited resources when it comes to education.
But if there are people who are high school dropouts, American citizens who are high school dropouts, who do have difficulty finding certain jobs, and we have a flood of 11 million undocumented immigrants who are doing fundamentally manual labor jobs, are they not taking jobs from Americans who need them because they can't work in an office, they can't do highly skilled jobs?
I mean, it's a difficult issue. You want to?
Well, I was going to say unemployment is low. I mean, it's not as if there's this flood of unemployed people who are saying, what can I do? Also,
but if you look at a home builder, if you look at home building around the area, most of the people working in those jobs are immigrants. Where are people who were born here? Why are they not hammering nails and putting roofs on houses? Is there a reason for that?
I mean, I don't know. But if you have, I think some of it is a mismatch of, that you have certain people who are unemployed, and they may not be in the exact places where the jobs are, whereas migrants will move and move constantly. As far as, say, home building in Charlotte, I don't know. It may well be that they've tapped out the large number of people who are already interested, and then there's still more demand because we're building like crazy.
Okay. Rob in Charlotte writes, as a former Border Patrol agent and a person who respects and appreciates Hispanic culture, why don't we offer a path to citizenship for those who are willing to participate in the U.S. military? They would learn how to be a patriot, the language, discipline, appreciation for the United States. I have had this discussion with many people of Hispanic heritage, and they would jump at the chance to give 4 years for this opportunity. Has that been discussed?
I think there is a program for that. And as a matter of fact, there is also a program for a pathway to citizenship for their immediate relatives, spouses, children, parents. It's called Parole in Place. And it's really a humanitarian notion that you wouldn't want your U.S. citizen military personnel to be under that stress of worrying about what was going to happen to their parents or their children or their spouses.
And finally, an email from someone who remains anonymous. How are illegal immigrants paying payroll taxes when they don't have Social Security numbers? Are they using stolen identities?
Stolen or fake? Yeah. Is that?
Can you just make up a number?
No. Well, in some cases, you could. I mean, you're going to have people who – there are professionals – who are making this and selling them in the black market. In some cases, they're also stolen, which is why people are paying into systems from which they will not be able to withdraw.
So if you steal somebody's Social Security number to use it on your employment forms, if you steal my number and use it on your employment form, I'm getting the credit.
That's right. That's right. But there is also a means for getting a tax ID number so that immigrants can, undocumented, yeah, can still pay their taxes.
Well, we're out of time, and I'm sorry for that because we haven't had a chance to talk about the case before the Supreme Court, which is the court taking action to deferred action
for parents.
Right, for parents, and I wish we had time to talk about that, but we don't, and we don't have time to talk about the anxiety over cultural differences, which is driving a lot of this. But that will be discussed, no doubt,
yes,
at the Queens Considers Forum tomorrow night at 5:30 at the I'm trying to find it on my
Duke Energy Theater
auditorium at Rogers Hall on campus, about which we have information on our website. Dr. Gregory Weeks, Dr. Margaret Cummins, Kathy Brennan, thank you all for the hour.